And welcome back to Real Clear with Dr. Klein, the crossroads of politics and psychology. If you would like to listen to ad-free episodes and have access to daily and weekly releases, essays, and other membership perks, and you also want to help in the production of this program, go to realclearpodcast.com and click subscribe. There are a lot of places in this world where you can put your money, and so I thank you for considering membership to realclearpodcast.com. I hope you enjoy this next episode. Go ahead and tell us again what your businesses are and so forth.
Yeah. So in university, I worked on Music Row for around 4.5 years and I was an executive producer at our studio at Vanderbilt as well. So one of my companies is in music production and audio engineering, where I work on beats and instrumentals, and then also audio engineering for artists all across the country. I do a lot of vocal production and just in general audio engineering work for folk on their songs. Then my other company is in marketing and website development. So I'll build websites for clients, and then I'll run their digital ads on all sorts of platforms, the social media platforms, and stuff like Unity and whatnot as well, just so that way we can get digital presences out there, make sales. And I specialize mostly in e-commerce areas and restaurants, two very different businesses, but it's just what I found myself doing over the past couple of years. And I've only person I've ever technically been employed for was the AZ GOP and Kari Lake during the 2022 campaign for 2 months. Other than that, I've entirely, every dime I've made has been on my own in my own businesses.
So, okay, the audience knows a bit about your backstory, right? From a very difficult childhood, obviously, with a major trauma, up through your aspiration to engage in public service, and you're obviously very entrepreneurial. Let's go into the top few issues facing Arizonans today and what your positions are on them.
Yeah.
So, one of the things that I'd like to bring to the audience's attention is the fact that American farmlands are being sold off to foreign investors. This is a crazy fact that a lot of people are unaware. And for instance, Chinese investors are buying millions and millions of acres of American farmland, even interestingly, abutting directly up against American military bases. This seems to me to be psychotic on the social level and on the policy level. What are your positions here?
If I were to go to Israel and try to buy land there, I could only get a lease for 99 years. Even if you were a citizen of Israel, you can only get a lease for 99 years. I think that's crazy. But if I were to go to Mexico, I can't buy land there. I believe it's the same deal, where you have to get a lease for however long their lease laws are. In America, I don't understand why it is that our government allows foreign entities to come in and purchase our land, especially in areas so close to military areas. And it's not just the Chinese. I want to, people focus on the Chinese because obviously they are our rival on the global stage. A third of Tolleson, last numbers that I read, is owned by a Canadian company. Now, I'm not sure if that's true. The Canadians have lowered their investment here in Arizona over the past couple of years due to the weakening of their dollar, Trudeau. However, and then the Saudis had a ton of farms over in the west of Arizona, still do. We didn't renew the leases on some of them, but what they're allowed to do with these farmland as well, we don't do rate metering or anything like that with water. So they can tap into these aquifers and take as much water as they want to basically draining it from any sort of future use, our existing farmers, and it's causing a mess that way. I don't like the idea that foreign entities can come in and outbid Arizonan families on single family homes. I think that farmland and single family homes are two things where we need to start being a little bit protectionist. I know that's a scary word. I'm a fair trade person, not a free trade or protectionist person. However, I do think that with our farmland and with our single family homes, we do need to start being a little bit more protectionist. Every other country is protectionist when it comes to their land and their property, especially their farmland and their single family homes. Why is America not doing the same thing? In Arizona, I would love to take any steps available to secure our lands or give incentives for Arizonan families to purchase these lands instead of the foreign entities. That way we can start to reverse the trends we're seeing. Homeownership rates are dropping, which is, I think, the worst sign for the American dream. And anything we can do to go increase homeownership rates and increase American ownership of farms, single family ownership of farms, not these mega farm owners such as Bill Gates, who bought most of Buckeye's available farms about a decade back or whatever that was. I believe that individuals owning their own property and being able to build generational wealth is incredibly important. We're taking that away from people by allowing foreign investors to come in and buy all of our land and then rent it out to people.
And when you say give incentives to Arizonans to purchase land and property, what exactly are you referencing?
I'm not sure if at the federal level we could restructure how loans are done for first-time home buyers, or if at the state level we could do some sort of tax kickback on people buying their first home or their primary residence. I'm not sure what that looks like. I'm all ears and I'm willing to have those conversations. I have a lot of different ideas that could turn into something, but that's the type of thing where I want to make sure that we're having these committee hearings and talking to the stakeholders to figure out how to best incentivize Arizonans to buy more homes and have more of their primary residences be owned by actual homeowners, or at least by local landlords, not by mega corporations or by foreign investors. I don't want to kill the local landlord. I think local landlords are an integral part of our community that we need to protect. But as we see with these bonkers rent control policies and with the influx of mega corporate investors, they're destroying the local landlord, which is terrible. We need to make sure that we protect our local landlords and that we protect our local homeowners.
I'm not sure if you've read Thomas Sowell much, but he makes pretty clear that anywhere there's rent control instituted, it actually increases rent prices.
Exactly.
And this is something that the left doesn't seem to understand, that anytime you subsidize something, you artificially increase the rate. One thing that blows my mind amongst the liberal progressives in America these days, especially those who talk about things like universal basic income, no one has yet to explain to me a very simple fact or answer to a question I have, which is, if you give everyone $10, for instance, of universal basic income, explain to me why $10 is not the new $0. Right?
This is when I was in high school, I was in speech and debate, and I did both cross-sex policy debate and I also did Lincoln-Douglas debate. One of our Lincoln-Douglas topics was the United States ought to implement a living wage. I began the topic, you have to debate both af and neg, pro and con. And I began it being pretty in the middle. Over the course of the 2 months where that was the topic, I became incredibly against the concept of what I call just raising the floor. Because what you do is, by artificially raising some arbitrary number, you're not making the people who are at the lowest rung of that number more wealthy. All you're doing is you're making it so that everyone between the former lowest number and new one where you're setting it at the lowest level. And so by raising the bottom, you're not making the people at the bottom any wealthier. You're just making it so there's more people at the bottom.
I would enhance that point by saying what was considered to be a raise is actually an evaporation of what was, because money is simply a representative of value. And if you untie currency to value or productivity, then it has no meaning. So $10, when not associated with effort, value, and product, all of a sudden evaporates in terms of its value. And that's why it would deflate the value of the dollar down to zero between 1 and 10. That's an economic fact.
Oh, and with how bad inflation's already been in this country, and I know people say, oh, we're doing better than other countries, we're still doing terribly compared to our own historical precedent. That would only blow our inflation more further out of the wazoo. And it's modern monetary theory only works up to the point where you have mass inflation. And so we need to prevent us from making our dollars worthless, which that would absolutely do. With 350 million people in this country, the amount of money that would devalue is absolutely insane. And if you think about how much of our money supply we've printed in the past couple of years, it would make it so that every couple of years we wind up printing massive percents of our money supply. It would be terrible for this country. I don't see how the dollar survives and how we wouldn't go full Venezuela.
But yeah, and economists are going to jump on me there. I meant to say devalue, not deflate the value of the dollar. And we just experienced a record inflation price from the last round of the stimulus checks that went out during the Biden administration, started during the Trump administration. But the last round of stimulus checks were completely unnecessary by all economic analyses from both sides, and led to a staggering inflation that's gripping the country. Now, that's a federal issue, not necessarily something that can be dealt with at the state level, reacted to, but not necessarily steered. Let's shift to something that can be steered and is a major problem. Obviously, the border is on everyone's mind. Bring us down to ground zero there in Arizona. What's going on?
I've been down to the border twice in the past year and a half. I went first time in early 2022 with Luis Pasolo, Gary Snyder, and a couple other people. And then I went again a couple months ago with Representative Michelle Pena. And the border. The first time I went there, I was down there, Yo Hablo Español, and I was speaking with a lot of the migrants coming across. Not a single one I spoke to was coming from Mexico. They were coming from Cuba, from Venezuela, from Georgia, from India, lots of random countries. And they would go line up by the wall. We went to the part by the Coco Pa Nation where the wall ends. It's right by, what is the Los Algodones in Mexico? It's by that area. And they would line up by the wall and they would wait for the Border Patrol agents to come down there. We were shooting a video for Luis Pasolo down there. And so the Border Patrol agents were like, can you please not put us in this? This is our job. We don't want to do what we have to do. They felt embarrassed over what they had to do, which was loading up these people into the vans. Most of them, 18, 30 year old males, very few families or women. There were some families and women though, of course, but it was a very small minority. They would load them up into the vans and bring them off to God knows where to get processed all across the country. When I came back a couple months ago, the only change was that this time there was a big tent around the wall to keep them safe. Yeah, to keep them safe from rain and whatnot. It was just a tent, like big poles, and then has a roof that you could see through the whole thing. And they had porta potties set up, and they had a big sign in Spanish that said, download this app in order to get processed faster. Now, the other thing that had changed was that the first time I had gone a year and a half ago, behind the wall, it was just a mess of clothes, IDs, teddy bears, all sorts of stuff left behind. This time when I went over there, it was spick and span clean. And if people don't bring in their identification, it affects how they can be processed and how they can receive asylum, all that. So if it's a complicated mess with loopholes that they take advantage of, and they're all told how to take advantage of it through TikTok and through their guides all across their coyotes guides all across the process. I think that what we need to do is reopen our checkpoints at places like Rubén, Sasabe, and or Arvaca. Forget the names of the cities, but I have them on my website on my Border Patrol policy. A couple of the Border Patrol checkpoints that we've closed over the past couple of years, I think we need to reopen them, have more checkpoints in order to do more apprehensions. I also believe we need to do more of what Texas is doing by using state resources and energy in order to combat the border crisis. We passed federally all of the laws that we need to follow in order to secure a border back in the 90s. What we need to do is actually follow those laws and stop and close up a lot of the loopholes in the process. My sister just got married to a Frenchman. She's having more trouble getting him to immigrate here legally, and they've been married for over a year, than if he were to just come across the border illegally. That's a problem.
Most people don't understand. They assume that legal immigration to the United States is easy. It's actually very hard and time consuming. And that makes it impossible for us to source the right people. And yes, everyone, I'm saying the right people. We don't want people who are unskilled, illiterate, and who we have no background checks on. I'm sure that there is a case to be made for anyone striving and making their way to the United States. But the reason a country has borders is so that it can select who it wants inside the borders. And right now, this seems to me to be the dissolution of an American ethos. There is no protection of what's inside the United States. There are people in this country who believe that there shouldn't be borders. Then there wouldn't be a country. I'm getting a little far afield here, but one of the issues that I'm really concerned about is the absence of fiscal responsibility in our policymakers. And before we get to the people, go ahead.
Okay. Before we get to fiscal responsibility, one more thing I want to mention on the border topic. I'm friends with the mining inspector here in Arizona, Paul Marsh, and we've toured around abandoned mines here in Maricopa County. And when we were going around one of them, I asked about their reclamation process for all the, we have 100,000 abandoned mines in Arizona due to the depression and due to mines closing, all that stuff. And we have plans to go back to a lot of the mines in the middle and north of Arizona to go see, are there resources here that we didn't use in the past that we can use now? Why are we not going to some of these abandoned mines in the south of Arizona? It's because there's a lot of sleeper cell agents who are going in and illegal migrants who are coming in, hiding out in these mines. They're armed. If you don't know, I believe 15,000 migrants from Mauritania crossed over the border and were processed last year. Mauritania is the number Al-Qaeda recruiting ground right now. There are terrorist cells in our country. A lot of them are hiding out in the abandoned mines or in other areas off the grid in this country, waiting for a moment to strike. It's not a matter of if something is going to happen. It's a matter of when something is going to happen. I believe, Senator Vance or Senator Cornyn, or some senator tweeted out a couple days ago that we are waiting basically just for another 9/11 to happen. All of the signs are there. It may not be planes in the Twin Towers, but we're waiting for some sort of terrorist attack to happen. We have let so many sleeper cell agents into this country, and we have done absolutely nothing about it.
Meanwhile, there's a federal judge in Illinois who just ruled yesterday or the day before that illegal immigrants can carry firearms.
Yeah, that's insane. That's absolutely insane.
Insane is the right word. Is this country going psychotic? I know that's my profession, but hell, you're at the level of politics. Is there any chance of making sense with the other side around these pivotal issues?
Yes. And so I'll get into that. So I would love to go at the state level, be able to supply the mining inspector with any sort of defense necessary in order for himself and his people to be able to go in these mines. Right now, they don't have that. They don't have the state's backing in order to feel safe when going down the south. So I'd love to, and reclaiming some of these mines, so I'd love to go buy that for them. When it comes to working with the other side on issues, I have my own disagreements with stuff in 2000 Mules, but I figured that just due to its cultural relevancy, it's important to go see. And I actually watched it with a Democratic legislator. And it obviously, both of us have our disagreements with things that were in that film, but we were able to watch it and at least be like, oh, wow, now we understand all of what's being said by that faction of the Republican Party. And that was a Democrat and me as a Republican, both able to watch that together and talk about it. Alex Colladan just passed a great bill, the elections bipartisan bill I was telling you about earlier, and both Katie Hobbs and Carrie Lake liked that bill. I do believe it's possible. Alex Colladan's mantra, and I love this mantra, and he said it once during a committee hearing, and I've just held on to it ever since, is that if you make the bills make so much sense that you just can't argue against them, then who's going to vote against it? And I think that's the perspective that we need to have as Republicans going forward, is let's try to take a step back and stop with name-calling and insulting the left all the time, and instead say, hey, look, we believe in these things. We have all these numbers and data and stats and philosophy and logic behind why we believe these things. Let's go present it in the best way possible, get our language and the bills to be bulletproof, make sure that we meet with the stakeholders who are against it to figure out why they're against it, and go plug any holes that we feel may cost us votes on getting the bills passed, and then get the bills passed making so much sense that they just can't argue against them. That's the perspective that I'm going to take when in office, and the one that I think that Republicans need to take more in general. If we stop, obviously we need to do some of the raw stuff in order to energize the base. But when it comes to actually getting our policies through and getting our agenda pushed, we need to be really smart about the legislation and about the process of getting people in a swing state like Arizona, where we have divided government, getting some Democrats on board with the legislation. That only happens by building relationships and building bridges with the Democrats, making them realize that, hey, we have political differences, but you are my fellow American, and I'm going to treat you and respect you like my fellow American. And let's talk about the issues like we were able to do 10, 20 years ago before the modern era, where it seems that politics is such a dirty thing for people to talk about cross aisle. A big reason why I've decided to get involved is because I think that in order for the Republican Party to survive, in order for us to have a conservative agenda passed, we need to start communicating better with people who disagree with us in order to go convince them of the thing that we believe in. We've done that on guns. The country has moved significantly to the right on the Second Amendment over the course of my lifetime, and I believe that we can do that on other issues as well.
That's a fine aspiration, and I applaud you for wanting to work across the aisle. I'm an independent, by the way, so I don't have a strong allegiance to the raw party politics of either side, but I do think that the left has gone almost insane on basic matters like immigration, like a general fiscal responsibility, not as though the old school Republicans are any better. But I'm going to press you into a difficult corner after what you've just said. You don't think that this kind of tribalization is helpful to our politics and to our populace. I agree with you. And you don't think name-calling and debasing your opponent is a good idea. I agree with you entirely. What do you have to say about Donald Trump?
Donald Trump was the best president of my lifetime on the issues. I certainly, if I were in this position, I would have probably said things a bit differently, but also he's as successful as it is, and as he is, in part because he has acted and been the way he's been. When I vote for someone, I am always a policy person first. He's the best president of my lifetime on policy, and it's not even close. And so,
what policies do you have in mind there, Ari?
Mostly foreign policy when it comes to the things I think about immediately with Trump. No new wars. He did the Abraham Accords. I'm Jewish and my mother grew up in Israel. And so I think the Abraham Accords were some of the most important things that he did while president. And as well, economically, I own, as an owner of two businesses, my business did so well. People had so much spare money. The feeling of the economy was great. So people had money to spend. They were starting new businesses. They were spending money on other people's businesses. The economic culture that he built in this country through tax policies, through his rhetoric, that helped a lot. And in addition, or some other thing with the border, what he had done with the border, raised apprehensions and lowered crossings from the Obama era, which was a travesty. And unfortunately, the left tried to label Trump for doing some stuff that Obama had done with the whole kids in cages crap. Most of the photos that the reporters were using were literally from the Obama era. And Trump actually decreased the rates of us separating parents and children dramatically, in part because we lowered the border crossings. So for Trump, foreign policy, I think he was by far the best president we've had. Economically, I think he's by far the best president we've had over the course of my lifetime. And I've had Clinton, then I had Bush, then I had Obama prior to Trump. And so Obama was a travesty economically. He was a travesty for this country in rhetoric, where he divided everyone based on race and immutable characteristics, which is straight up Marxist. It's horrible. Bush was the absolute worst foreign policy wise. I think the war in Iraq was a complete mistake. Trump was completely right when he called that a mistake from the get-go. And I don't think we should have been going into Iraq. I think the Afghanistan war was also a pretty big mistake as well, and that countless Americans lost their lives. And I think the Republicans lost a lot of ground due to some of the rhetoric that Bush was using during his era. I'm glad to see that we've moved on from that. I considered myself a Ron Paul Republican through a lot of that time, and it's because I wanted to see the kind of logic and reason Republicans prevail over this emotional evangelocon rhetoric that I saw George Bush and later Mike Pence use a lot. I come from just the more classically liberal side of the Republican Party. That's more, I believe in the beliefs of our founders. I want to make sure things are constitutional. I want to make sure that we are preserving the culture of this country, and that we are making sure that we have a country to give to the next generation that protects Americans and Arizonans first. In the state level, Arizonans first; at the country level, Americans first.
So you're quick on your feet. I like that. And you're intuitive. One of the contradictions in your positions, however, we need to drill in on. And that is that you say on one hand, and I agree with you entirely, that you want to make very reasonable bills and you'd like to have them make so much sense that other people aren't going to part from your side based on partisan politics. And also you make the point that it is the viciousness and rhetorical demeaning tendencies of our politicians that causes a parting of ways unnecessarily, which detracts from our ability to legislate. It's difficult to hold those two positions and simultaneously only peripherally comment on the president's rhetoric. Don't you think that if that's your position, that you could also make the claim that the president's mannerisms and rhetoric and way of carrying himself and addressing his opponents actually denudes him of political effectiveness?
I certainly think that Trump would have more allies in Congress if he were to change his rhetoric. I don't know if he would have the same support base that he has, though, in when it comes to the general populace and voting base. And so it's a trade-off that I think Trump's an incredibly intelligent person. I think that's something that he probably thinks about, is how does my rhetoric affect my base? How does it affect my ability to compete in this race? And also, how does it affect my ability to work with Congress? So but at the end of the day, I wouldn't be doing things the same way that he does, but he's been successful. I think he could be more successful in working with Congress if he would change his rhetoric regarding a number of things. But at the end of the day, it's Trump is Trump, and it's federal politics is the presidential position. There's a disconnect. He's been in politics for 10 years at this point, and so it's, I just hold it outside. Like, Trump is Trump, exactly what you said. It's a bit detached for me. Like, I support Trump. I voted for him yesterday in the primary. You know, rhetorically, I think that most Republican politicians shouldn't be following that kind of bark mode.
Okay, I'm done pressing you on that matter.
It doesn't fit me.
By the way, I think that what you've stated in terms of his policies are largely entirely accurate. Most people, however, aren't even aware of what the Abraham Accords are. It was so buried and was such a successful policy. By the way, it's surprising that it wasn't given more coverage. Okay, so in terms of Arizona, that's where you're running. That's your forte. That's what's going on in your political world. We talked about farmlands. We've talked about military-age men crossing the border from all kinds of different countries, and I provided the context of left-wing federal judges allowing illegals to carry firearms in the United States. Completely insane. What is your position on law enforcement in Arizona? And just for a backdrop, I'm extraordinarily pro-law enforcement, and I think that what's been going on in this country has been, in no uncertain terms, the ingredients necessary to disband civilization.
Yeah, I love our law enforcement officers. I just did a 5K, an honor walk for the Phoenix police a couple days ago. And we had introduced a bill. I'm not sure what happened, but I'll have to follow up with the sponsor on it from Representative Marshall that actually preempts the cities and says that you're not allowed to defund the police year over year without, I believe, legislative approval or something. So it basically prevents these cities from arbitrarily defunding their police year over year. I think some sort of legislation like that would be amazing. I'd have to go chat with the cities and make sure that we're not missing anything. But I think we need to make sure that we protect our law enforcement, that we stop them from being defunded. And I think we need to have good training for our law enforcement as well. You don't like to see officers who don't have, we don't like to see police departments without enough money to provide for the adequate training and resources that their law enforcement officers need. So I want to make sure that we are providing that for all of our municipalities. That way we have good, respected law enforcement in our country. I think that law enforcement would be a hell of a lot more respected if we turned our freeways into autobahns. That may be a controversial opinion, but I think a lot of people don't like the notion that police can just pull you over on the freeway if you're going 5 miles over the speed limit on the freeway. I think that a lot of people just get, it goes from seeing a policeman on the road feeling safe to seeing a policeman on the road and thinking, oh, if I do one thing wrong, he's going to go ruin my day. So I think that we need to take a look at some of our policies that, in my opinion, are wasting police time and ruining the public's perception of them, and make sure that we fund them and give them enough time and resources to be able to do the things that really matter to our community. Crime is rising rampantly in Phoenix, especially in my district, the western side of my district. Without fail, every single family says the crime and the homelessness is getting worse. We need to make sure that our law enforcement officers and our first responders in general have the resources, have the training, and have the ability to respond to those situations.
Oh, but Ari, didn't you watch the State of the Union? President Biden said crime is going down.
That's just a lie. Anyone in my district could tell you that's a lie. I don't think there's any part of my district where crime is going down. It's an area where people nowadays, when I was knocking doors, there was a precinct where I had to go walk 5 doors between homes because everyone was gated up. People are not feeling safe in their own homes nowadays. The amount of gated neighborhoods going up all across the East Valley or the Northeast Valley is staggering. There's some areas where entire precincts are just gated homes now. Crime is rising and people are feeling it and people are recognizing it. You wouldn't be seeing the responses people are taking by gating up their own personal homes or moving to gated neighborhoods or converting their neighborhoods to gated neighborhoods if there wasn't this massive fear of crime, and it's a legitimate fear. You go on Nextdoor, the app that for local things, and people are constantly saying, stolen this, stolen that, car jacked, the hubcap taken.
It's since 2019. The massive spike in crime that ensued after our demoralization of the police forces, there was a slight decline in 2023, and that's what the Biden administration is calling a crime being down. It's as if you walk to the top of a mountain and you increase your elevation, and then you walk 5 feet back down the mountain and say you've walked down all the way. It's a complete lie, and a lot of people are moving away from cities. I see the new American divide as being one between city and rural. Do you see it that way?
If you would like to listen to ad-free episodes and have access to daily and weekly releases, essays, and other membership perks, and you also want to help in the production of this program, go to realclearpodcast.com and click subscribe. There are a lot of places in this world where you can put your money, and so I thank you for considering membership to realclearpodcast.com.
No, I think that's a very easy way to look at things, because in the rural areas, I think 80, 90% of Americans are going to wind up moving more conservative, Republican. You maybe see it, but In the suburbs, I think things are still very split. And in the city, I think there's a different type of Republican that is both emerging and existing. You have both parties are big tent parties. You know, on the left, you have the neoliberals, you have the straight up commies, you have the environmental folk, et cetera. On the right, you have everyone from classical liberals to evangelocons to business conservatives. And it all meshes together to form the general conservative movement on the Republican side and the general liberal movement over on the Democratic side. I think that on the right, you do see a lot of city Republicans, especially on the Northeast, people like Charlie Baker, people like Phil Scott, people who don't really fit in with the culture views of the rural Republican crowd. And I think that's also a growing sentiment in the cities, that you're having a lot of these city Republicans start to emerge. And they aren't necessarily in the current base, but I do think it's a rising group of people. I also think that the more conservatarian folk, ever since the Libertarian Party has gone absolutely off the rails over the past 10 years and is starting to open borders and all this other wild stuff, I think a lot of the more traditional Ron Paul, Rand Paul, Ayn Rand libertarians are moving to be Republicans and forming a larger caucus in that in the party as well. So I do, and I think a lot of those are city folk. I don't think those are rural folk. I think a lot of those are city folk. So I think in the cities, you have obviously still Democratic prominence, but I do think conservatives are becoming more prominent in the cities and in the suburbs. They're always going to be 50-50, at least for the next 10 years. And a large part of that is due to suburban women moving away from the Republican Party, whereas suburban men who are minorities are moving more towards the Republican Party. I think it's a more complicated thing than urban versus rural, just because there are urban Republicans who are, I see, on the rise and becoming more of a presence in general in the party, which is a good thing. It means the Republican Party's numbers are growing. I don't see a lot of rural Democrats growing. I see rural Democratic presence going down. So I do think the future looks bright for the GOP, so long as we can maintain the coalition that we're currently constructing, that we've been constructing since the Trump era.
One complication in the statistic that you just described of women moving more and more toward the Democrat Party, well, a correlation to that statistic is that 50%, one out of two of every white woman in America right now is diagnosable with a severe mental health condition. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know that. One in two. It's a staggering statistic. So I just like to posit that there. It's a much broader topic than we could possibly entertain right now. But here's a question for you, perhaps as we gear towards an ending. Why should a Democrat vote for you?
I'll be the one who listens to people no matter what their position on the aisle is. I have my views and my beliefs I'm not going to settle on or compromise on, but I want to make sure that I'm always listening to folk and to keep an open door. My mind's been changed on things before. Preemption is one that I had my mind changed on earlier this year, where at first I was not as much in favor of preemption, and now I'm more in favor of preemption. That's when the state goes in and tells the cities what they can and can't do. It does depend on the issue, but in general, I've become more in favor of that over time. So I think listening to folk in that preemption is also a very Republican conservative thing. The Free Enterprise Club is the one who's really in favor of that. They're the ones who actually convinced me on becoming more pro preemption. So I'm willing to listen to people no matter what their concerns are. When it comes to the Dems, my argument to them is going to be, look, I believe in individual rights first. I want to protect our First Amendment rights above all. I want to make sure that we protect our environment by making sure that we can go up to northern Arizona and stop the bark beetle crisis that's reduced our forest cover by 14% over the past 20 years. I want to make sure that we protect our long-term water supply by making sure that we have a statewide water market to go replenish our depleting aquifers with overflowing aquifers, and that we introduce a 100-year water guarantee for rental-only builds. That way, not only do we save water, but that we prevent a crisis in 30 years, that we also are able to incentivize developers to build more for-sale homes with the 100-year water guarantee. So environmentally, a lot of people on the left are big environmental folk. I believe pragmatic environmentalism, Teddy Roosevelt environmentalism, is the way to go win those people over. And again, it goes back to making sure that the policies make so much sense that they are like, wow, we believe in that too. Do you want to protect the environment in Arizona? Protect our forests, protect our water. I see two easy ways to, not easy, but two ways to do that. Stop the bark beetles up north and secure our water for the long term by getting rid of some of the bureaucratic mess we have. When it comes to other things, I supported the medicalization and legalization of marijuana, and Republicans are actually the ones who are introducing the bill to medicalize psilocybin for medical use over in this state. And I fully support T.J. Shope and Kevin Payne's efforts on that as well. I think psilocybin legalization is for medical purposes, not for recreational, but for medical purposes, is another good thing that we could be doing in the state. The veterans are pushing for it. And of course, the Democrats are in favor as well. And that because the veterans have been lobbying so much for it, that's why Republicans have actually been the ones to introduce the bills on that topic. And then when it comes to the economy on that as well, the Dems often like to point to the fiscal irresponsibility of the current Republican legislature. We have a $400 million deficit, largely due to $2.5 billion of one-off projects and bad appropriations. So an example I like to give, it's a very nerdy example, but there was two road bills that I like to talk about. One of them was for a two-mile stretch of road in Prescott Valley on a mountainous area, curved road, $6 million for that road. Another was for a one-mile stretch of road in Buckeye on flat land, $22 million. Things like that, we should be asking a lot of questions about. They should be raising eyebrows, and right now they're not raising eyebrows. I believe that we need to bring back some sort of fiscal responsibility, bring in a business owner who is a budget nerd and is going to go through those things and make sure that we're not wasting money so that way we could get our $400 million deficit overturned. The Dems like to go point at saying, oh, school choice is taking away money from public schools and bankrupting our state. The two counters of that are, number one, let's go save money by reducing our appropriations in areas where they don't make sense, like some of those roads. And number two, with the ESA program, what so many Dems don't understand, and I would love to be able to communicate this as best I can to them, I'm going to be doing ads and mailers on it as well, is with the ESAs, if you take out the money, you get around $7,000 for your kid out of the $14,000 total allotted. And the other $7,000 is actually kicked back to the public schools. That way they can increase their per pupil spending. So our ESA program, which Ducey signed into law during his last year, actually allows school choice while improving our public schools at the same time. It's a genius program, one that we must make sure has long-term viability financially, and also that the people understand how it helps our public schools as well as helps people you go to schools of their own choice and private or at home. So for the Dems, I would love to just let them know that, hey, look, on the environment, on education, on our economy, on medical things such as fighting big pharma and making sure that we have medical psilocybin and THC available for the patients who need it, I'm on your side on those things, because at the end of the day, I believe in the individual liberty of people first. I believe in constitutionality, and we're not always going to agree on everything, but I'll always be just one phone call or email away, and then we can at least talk about it.
Ari Bradshaw, we hope you have good chances, and thanks for coming on Real Clear Podcast. You're always welcome back.
Thank you, Lucas. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your kind words and look forward to being able to return at some point.